You are listening to National Security Law Today.
I'm Elisa Poteet, and welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Tonight, we're returning to the fourth in our non-consecutive series on political appointments. So tonight, before we get to our substantive and lengthy national security news, we're going to finish the conversation on this topic by discussing something known as recess appointments. Now, if you want some of the basics before you get into this more narrow topic regarding appointments, you can listen to my conversation with Eric Schwab on the appointments process from inside the Capitol, or my conversation with Arnold Punaro, author of If Confirmed, very substantive casts on exactly what the process looks like, including all of the vetting. But tonight, we're talking to Neil Eggleston, who was White House counsel to President Obama, associate counsel to President Clinton. And he's also served as deputy chief counsel of the U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the Iran-Contra affair. Boy, Neil, that's a great conversation. We're going to have that one day. I got to tell you. So I imagine you know Judge Friedman, right?
I do.
Gosh, there would be so much gossip to delve into. You've also been the chief appellate attorney for SDNY, which is, you know, not a small job. But now you're a partner in a law of Kirkland and Ellis, and I'm really glad that you came to talk to us tonight.
Of course. Glad to be here. Thank you.
We're going to go very sort of basic here. What is a recess appointment?
So let me start. We're really talking about principal officers, like cabinet secretaries, for example. Those are the people we're really talking about. So the Constitution, the baseline, if you will, is what we all know about, which is the president nominates somebody, the nomination is sent to the Senate has hearings, and then the committee votes, and then the Senate votes about whether to confirm the person or not. That's what we're used to. There's another provision in the Constitution, though, that provides for recess appointments, and it permits the president to make recess appointments for limited periods of time. And we'll talk about this a little bit more when we get the lead case on this called Mulcahy. But a recess appointment, as the name sounds, occurs during a recess of the Senate. So if the Senate is in a recess, the president has the opportunity to appoint someone to that position without any Senate consideration, but for a fairly limited amount of time through the end of that session of Congress, which is at most 2 years. So that's what a recess appointment is.
But these have kind of a fun history, don't they? Doesn't this date back to a time when, I guess, the Senate wasn't sitting all the time, right? And you had to get there by horse or something, and maybe you couldn't make it. You know, God knows what might happen on the way, right?
Really? I mean, you have to remember, this is all, for those of us who are originalists or people who are originalists, this is all done by the framers. And Congress sat, I think, sort of once a year. And as you just said, Lisa, they came in by horse, and it was not easy to get there, and it was not easy to summon them. And so the framers put in this provision to give the president the opportunity to make appointments during the recess, because otherwise the president could be months and months and months without the Senate even having an opportunity to look at what the nomination was. And so it really was a function of the logistics of the Senate meeting at the time. That's the reason it got into the Constitution, I think.
Boy, can you imagine a situation in which they meet once a year and we don't have to listen to that ceaseless theater on C-SPAN, Neil? That would be so awesome. Let's talk about what happened in 2014 that brought the Supreme Court sort of into the issue of recess appointments, because it seems like near history, but I think a lot of our listeners are young and they might not remember how momentous this was.
Yeah, so it actually, at the time the case came down, I was White House counsel to President Obama. I was not part of the decision to bring the case. That was by my predecessor, maybe even her predecessor. But essentially, the case is called NLRB v. Noel Canning. And let me just spend just a second talking about it. So in 2011, President Obama made recess appointments of three of the five members of NLRB. And he did it during what he called a recess. And at the time, the Senate was doing these pro forma sessions. So every 3 days, they'd have a senator stand up and say something like, "I call the Senate to order. Is there any business?" No. And he would slam down the gavel and it would be done. The Senate took the position that that was not a recess, that they were actually in session and they could conduct business and all that kind of stuff. And so President Obama said, "Aha, that's bogus. That's actually a recess. I can make a recess appointment. And he made the appointment of these three people. Noel Canning was a Pepsi distributor. The NLRB issued some order against him, and he challenged the order on the grounds that the NLRB was not constitutionally formulated because three of the five were unconstitutionally appointed. And so that's how the case came up. It came up through the DC Circuit, and then it got to the Supreme Court. But that's sort of the background of the case. As I say, I wasn't White House counsel when this decision was made, but I suspect that this was an intentional test case because at the time, remember, this isn't true anymore, but at the time, nominations like this required 50 votes for confirmation, but 60 votes to get a vote because you needed cloture. And so even though President Obama had a majority of the Senate, which he had up until 2014, he still couldn't get a lot of his nominees through because he needed Republican votes to get beyond cloture. And I'm sure the thought about this was, let's test this. If we're right, we can get around the obstruction of Senate. And if we're wrong, we're no worse than where we are today. Let me put it this way. That's the way I would have thought about it if I'd been White House counsel at the time. And I'm sure that's the way they thought about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So two things. One is for our listeners who don't know, it's the National Labor Relations Board. You may not think of it every single day, but when you see things like a baseball player strike, sometimes they get in the middle of it in ways that they're sort of invisible to you as the general public, but they're actually instrumental sometimes in resolving these massive disputes that may have an effect on something as small as sort of your lifestyle experiences. So this was obviously a big deal. Now, with respect to test cases, dangerous territory, right? I mean, you say, damn the torpedoes, who cares about secondary and tertiary consequences? It doesn't mean if we win this time, they'll use it against us the next time.
Yeah, this was one they probably should not have done. I mean, if you want me to talk about the case generally, I mean, it turned out to be unanimous against President Obama.
Yeah, I think you should talk about it because, I mean, I like to believe that we're going to move at some point in our future to a less divided America. I mean, we've been here before, right? The Vietnam War certainly divided the country extensively, and we do experience divisions, which I think are inherently a threat to national security. But I think actually talking about a case and the facts is always helpful.
I regard this case as super fascinating. And I teach constitutional law at presidential power at Harvard Law School. And I frequently had this on the syllabus because I'm so fascinated by this case. So the majority was written by Justice Breyer. And it was joined by only two justices who are currently on the court, Kagan and Sotomayor. The others have all retired. And essentially, there were kind of two issues. And if you look at the language of the provision, it's super fascinating. It's Article 2, Section 3, and it says, the president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate. So the case
like the vacancy has to happen by that language, right?
Well, this is the issue that the majority and the concurrence fought about. So the language is vacancies that may happen, and then during the recess. So Breyer, writing for 5 of 9, says essentially, okay, you would think that the language means the vacancy has to come up during the recess, but we're not going to read it that way. Both of these will be important if this issue becomes something that President Trump tries to do. And the other thing that Breyer says is there are two places where there can be a recess. One is between sessions. So Congress is in session for 2 years. It basically follows the House election. So Congress is in session for 2 years and it goes out of session in January. It's going to go out of session in January of 2025, next month. And then we'll immediately go in session and both the new House and the new Senate will be sworn in. And that session lasts for 2 years until January of 2027. Another question was, does recess in the Constitution mean between these two sessions? Or can it mean just a recess that takes place during the course of a session? So Breyer answers these two questions by saying, first, the vacancy does not have to happen during the recess. And second, it applies to intersession as well as intrasession recesses. And then finally, he says, but the recess, whatever the recess is, it has to be at least 10 days. before the president can make a recess appointment. So very sort of generous and not an obvious reading. So then Scalia comes
I like up. The way you put that.
So
really wonderful White House diplomacy, sir.
So then Scalia, who has this fascinating concurrence in the judgment, and he talks a lot about separation of powers and how separation of powers is designed to protect liberty, not to protect the Senate. And what he says is that Breyer is wrong on both these counts. And he's joined, interestingly, by three people still on the court. So Thomas, Alito, and Roberts all join him. And they hold, one, that the vacancy has to arise during the recess. And the second, the recess has to be between sessions.
Okay, and let's talk about that language. So
sure.
What exactly does Section 3 of Article 2 say that weds us again to the between sessions conclusion?
On that issue, it just says during the recess of the Senate. But Scalia goes back and does one of these originalism things and says at the time, recess, which is capitalized in the Constitution, but like everything's capitalized, so that's not.
Yeah.
But that recess at the time meant recess between the sessions. It didn't just mean a time during the session when they decide not to sit, that it actually meant sort of doing historical work. He goes back and says recess at the time actually only meant recess between the sessions, and therefore the language here only means recess between the sessions.
So, and just out of curiosity, this being something you have obviously thought out about at length, I mean, where did he come up with that? Did he mine the Federalist Papers? Was there some sort of rule in place? Were there other cases? Was there some law that defined the concept of recess period?
I think he would say he looked at the Federalist Papers. I think that his historical support is not overwhelming for this position. But it's pretty convincing. I think it's actually fairly convincing. His basic argument is that recess was meant to be formal. And the only actual recess that actually has to happen is the recess between the sessions. All the other recesses are sort of discretionary. They can take them. They don't have to take them if they don't want to. And so the only thing that the Constitution was actually referring to was the one recess that has to happen, which is the recess between the sessions of Congress. That's kind of what is.
You know, it seems like a reasonable reading. Yeah, I know it depends on what your Weltanschauung is, right? Because, I mean, it's interesting. In my son's elementary school, the Federalist Papers are taught as propaganda that was intended to persuade us to go along with the idea of a new government. You know, they were published in various places. I mean, let's sort of put them in historical context. They were published in newspapers. They were disseminated around to try to persuade what was then, you know, effectively colonists that, you know, we needed to form a democracy. We needed to form something that looked a heck of a lot better than what we had with the crown and England. I think I've always wondered is, were they written to be mined and interpreted at this level of detail, if indeed they were simply persuasive papers? And that is one interpretation of the value that they had in the moment, which is not intended to be a forward-looking 250 years later value.
So I agree with that. The other thing, you see this periodically, particularly with Hamilton, he was ungodly smart. And I think the other thing that he did, and I think this is sort of true, he gets kind of cited in sea level and those kind of stuff, which is I think he's thinking to himself, I'm losing some of these battles in the convention, the Constitutional Convention, but if I write about the way they should interpret it, maybe I'll win in history. Do you know what I mean? I think the other thing that always bugs me as a constitutional law teacher is that we essentially cite Madison and Hamilton as if they're the only people there and as if what happens in the states, who are the actual ratifiers, we never cite to anything that they're talking about, it seems to me. We basically cite to Madison and Hamilton. Sometimes we cite to Jefferson, who was not actually at the Constitutional Convention. Right? Because he's off in France at the time.
He was off in France. That's right. With Sally Hemings on another conversation. But yes.
Exactly. So I do think, though, that I think Scalia is probably right on this piece. And I want to come back to how it matters today.
Yeah, it sounds right. Yeah.
But I think it's actually stronger even on the happening, the power to fill vacancies that may happen during the recess. And Breyer says, well, may happen means may still exist during the recess, so that even if it occurred, the vacancy occurred before the recess, it is happening during the recess because it's still there. I think that I'm kind of with Scalia on this one.
Yeah, he does. You know, even if he's not to your cup of tea, or, you know, you think he would look like Jack Nicholson in The Shining or whatever your idea of him is, he's crazy, right? Sometimes about a lot of things.
Yes.
And
yes.
Just listening to you right now, it does sound to me like, he was right on. The plain language of that section of the Constitution, at least to me, appears clear. Now, where there's no indication there, obviously, about a session, but there is a certain logic in that. And it almost falls, as we were talking about people not even being available, sessions being more spread out. There probably wasn't the opportunity to deal with this. And there weren't successive recesses, or the entire thing was a recess all the time, if you construe it that widely, because, hey, I had to ride my horse back to Connecticut.
Right.
And it's going to take me several days to come back. And, oh, by the way, several rivers froze and I can't do that.
Yes. Yeah. And to, Maine and South Carolina and sort of all these states. The reason that I think this concurrence is so interesting in today's, the intercession takes place in early January of 2025. President Trump is inaugurated on January 20th, and there will be no vacancies that arise in the nanosecond between the end of the last session and the beginning of the first session. And secondly, if you believe both halves of Scalia, he also has to make the appointment during the intercession recess, which would mean essentially that if you follow Scalia, who was joined by Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, and the people we haven't heard from yet are Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett.
Comey Barrett, right.
And Amy Comey Barrett. We haven't heard from them because they weren't on the court at the time this happened. If you follow essentially what three of the justices have already ruled, President Trump cannot make a recess appointment because neither one of these will be fulfilled, because the intercession is going to take place 3 weeks before he's inaugurated.
Okay, well, that's interesting. But let's talk for a little bit of history here, because I think it's important. Hamilton obviously was no fan of recess appointments, but apparently Eisenhower was. And I think it might be interesting. I look to see who he appointed during recess. What I find fascinating is there was one Supreme Court justice, I think, who is, presided over some of the most important civil rights, for example, order opinions of the court in history. And that was Earl Warren, who did not have, by the way, a background as a liberal. In fact, some would say he wasn't a terribly nice guy before he got on the court, and he rose to the occasion and found his inner nobility. But Brennan was also appointed by Eisenhower during this time, as was Potter Stewart. I mean, are there other recess appointments that have proven to be incredibly well considered over time? Is there a place for this occasionally? Has it worked to the benefit of the United States citizens at times?
So I know about those three. And as you just said, it's sort of, and mind you, obviously all three were eventually nominated and confirmed by the Senate. So they didn't just serve as recess appointments, because otherwise their appointments would have ended in 2 years or less. And they were all, I think today, as split as we are, that if someone's got a recess appointment, the likelihood that they get confirmed is probably down, because the Senate would be, I think at least the Senate would be concerned that it's an assault sort of on their prerogative and all that kind of stuff. So just to give you, I went to get some statistics. I only went back as far as President Clinton. President Clinton had 139 recess appointments. I don't know that any of those were judges. President Bush had 171, and President Obama had 32. But mind you, after Noel Canning came out, the Senate then entirely used this method of having pro forma sessions to eliminate recesses. And so his ability to do recess appointments essentially ended. I can't think, and I may just be having a memory lapse here, but I don't think of anybody as momentous as Earl Warren. And I would put Justice Brennan, who was also in that court, who was just a monumental judicial figure of his time. He was obviously on, sort of on the Warren court, although he stayed. But I think those are probably the two most significant. I think most of these are like what I described on Noel Canning, which is filling up boards. It's doing that kind of stuff. And I don't remember cabinet secretaries and people really at that level getting recess appointments. And I even think that I don't even remember any in the President Trump era, you know, the first term where somebody at that level got a recess appointment. Before we end, I want to talk just a minute about the Vacancy Reform Act. I don't think we're there yet, but President Trump actually made more use, I think, of the Vacancy Reform Act.
Let's go back and talk for just a minute about how recess appointments might be blocked, because there has been effort. Obviously, you're talking about the pro forma sessions. And basically what you're saying is they open and close the session without there being any discussion, really, any debate, anything entered in the record other than the beginning and the end of the session. So I heard you loud and clear on that. There must be other procedural techniques that have been deployed in order to block these recess appointments. And can you talk about that briefly?
Well, I think really, particularly since Noel Canning, I think the one that this, I mean, Senate essentially for President Obama, essentially we would negotiate with the Senate, like over Christmas, for example, or the holidays, I should say. You know, a senator didn't want to be there every 3 days, like on the day after Christmas. And we would negotiate, they'll confirm these 10 people and we'll agree not to make any recess appointments, for example. We would.
Is that horse trading, Neil? Are we talking horse trading?
That sounds
a little like horse trading.
That's horse trading, but that, you know, that's politics. That happened. So we would use it. It was a presidential power that we got stuff for, and then, you know, gave away the right to make recess appointments through bargaining. And obviously you would never renege on your deal. But otherwise, the principal way that, particularly if the president is a Democrat, as Obama was, obviously in the Senate by November 2014, the Senate had become Republican. The principal way to do it is really for the Senate essentially never have a recess. And that's the way they block the president from making any recess appointments. That's sort of the way they did it.
Let's just talk about doing the recess appointment thing. And I'm still in my head. I'm like, I'll tell you what, I'll raise you no recess appointments if you'll give me these nominees.
Was that too sort of raw politics for you?
It's just, listen, everybody's seen House of Cards, Neil. This is almost antiseptic. So I think that it's pretty anodyne. But I think one of the things that we've talked about the last, you know, couple of episodes is the important role that vetting plays in an individual. I think the strongest, most intelligent politician is constantly being ambushed with things about his potential subordinates that were not communicated to him or her. And I actually think this is a significant problem. I am sure, and you know this working in the White House, I feel one of the roles of a subordinate is to brief up and to do so effectively. Don't go and say something. You know, if there's something important that your leadership needs to know, you must, even if they don't want to hear it, even if they want to shoot the messenger, it's your job to tell them. But to be frank, we have seen this over and over again with nominees where somebody had to know that this individual had problems, significant problems. Now, I'm not saying that problems mean you're a bad guy, right? Oral Warren was accused of being, what, a white supremacist?
Yeah.
And he turns out to be a wonderful guy, right? But nevertheless.
Well, I said yes to Warren, but just to think about Black certainly was.
Black, that's right. But I think Warren had some other issues vis-a-vis civil rights, maybe in Mexican Americans or something.
I remember that less. I remember Black obviously was accused of being a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Wow, yeah. But Warren had some things that I mean, I guess if you were doing them today and you were going to splash them across, you know, X or Insta, you know, maybe he wouldn't look that good. And they would be amplified more than maybe some of his other character traits, you know, like that one error would be, you know, waved around. But nevertheless, it seems like the vetting process is a critical one. What happens when you have recess appointments to this whole vetting process?
If there is a recess appointment, then the president just gets to do it. And there doesn't have to be, I mean, the president could decide, and I think most presidents would decide, I don't want to make a recess appointment of someone who, as soon as the press hears his name or her name, is going to dig up and find out that they have all sorts of problems of one type or another in their background. So you would like to think that most presidents would want a pretty pretty aggressive vetting anyway, because it'll sort of blow back on them, because they're the ones who did the nomination. But as a sort of a legal matter, the whole point of a recess appointment is to cut the Senate out of the process. In some ways, in that process, you're betting for the press, but you're not really betting for the Senate, because the Senate doesn't get the opportunity to vote on the appointee. So then it becomes kind of a matter of how the politics are going to look. President is a little different, because by the time I got there, Bill Kennedy came down in 2014. We weren't doing recess appointments after I got there, but it was critically important to him that, as you just said, Lisa, if there were problems with his nominees, he wanted to know about it before he nominated them. There may be ones that he thought, okay, I hear it. I'm willing to stand by this person. But I, President Obama, have the ability to decide whether I want to do that or not. But I darn well better know about it before I make the nomination. So he cared. I mean, he cared a lot about it. And it was part of my office, actually, that vetted particularly cabinet level and principal officers. That was a White House function. It also happened in the agencies, but it was a White House function because it was deemed to be just so important, because there was so much blowback that would take place to whomever the president is. And I think I say that happened in Obama, but I think it happened in Clinton, where I was also in the White House counsel's office. And I'm sure it happened in Bush. And
yeah, cared and wanted to be fully informed, as you mentioned, yes, so that he could be part of the decision-making process. He could have all the facts. I would note, you know, Obama was a lawyer. I think lawyers tend to want to have all the facts, yes, and maybe sometimes even more than they need. So what's on the offing to change any of this? There's been some proposed legislation over the years. What are your thoughts about what could make this process a little bit better, to better serve the American public, to make government function better, and to, you know, make sure that our cabinet members are fully accountable and are people that we can trust?
We've talked a little bit about Scalia's concurrence and Noel Canning, and also Justice Thomas in another case called Southwest General, which came out in 2017, which was a Federal Vacancies Reform Act case, which was kind of a dry technical how the statute worked. But Thomas actually concurred. But he wrote that he thought the Federal Vacancy Reform Act was unconstitutional because it was an alternative method of putting people into principal officer jobs. And the Constitution provided the only method. And that is, the two methods are advice and consent and recess appointments. And his view was the Federal Vacancy Reform Act was a statutory method that was sort of watered those provisions down. And as a result, that they were unconstitutional. And where I was headed is that both Scalia and Thomas were very strong, as frankly, you talked about Hamilton earlier, but as Hamilton talked about this, he did talk about how important, the three of them all talked about how important this was to separation of powers, which is the president has the power of nomination, but it's critical that the Senate has its role. And actually, Hamilton, I think it's Federalist Paper 76, I can't remember the number, talked about the danger of, if there's not a Senate role, that a president could appoint his friends and family, and there would be really no check if there weren't Senate involvement through advice and consent in the process, and how important that was to get the right people in office, because they're important offices and all that kind of stuff. But very heavy reliance on both of those, on the importance of separation of powers. As I mentioned earlier, Thomas says, well, it may be that the Senate passed the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, but separation of powers is not to protect the Senate, it's to protect liberty. It's so that these people have gone through essentially, as you said, a vetting process and vote by the Senate, so that we know that we have the right people there. And that's a critical component of our separation of powers. And that's not around to protect the Senate, that's around to protect liberty. So it'll be interesting. So where you asked a question a minute ago, and I'm finally getting back to it.
And then that's fine. We like
that. Well, no. But if the president, President Trump, does make recess appointments, I mean, as I say, he can't do an intercession one because the intercession will have ended. If it works such that he does it, I suspect there will be litigation that may well go to the Supreme Court. And it'll sort of, with three justices already weighing in on this, which would essentially say that the recess appointment by President Trump would be unlawful, unconstitutional, it would be interesting to see whether there are two other votes for that. The two justices remaining who joined Breyer, I think I mentioned before, are Kagan and Sotomayor. Otherwise, I'm not entirely sure how you really, other than insisting on following sort of the main method of Senate advice and consent, because it's in the Constitution, I'm just not sure what statutory work there is to be done to help this out. I do think there are things they could do, and presidents get frustrated over this. They probably have way too many principal officers or officers subject to Senate confirmation.
So we let's explain this, because this isn't something that I always understood. But, you know, there are a number of positions that are appointed where no Senate confirmation is required. And can you give us an example of what one of those might be?
Well, just in the Justice Department, the chief of the fraud section, very important job, important to the enforcement of the federal criminal laws in the country, but not, I think, a presidential appointee. I think, although I used to fight with the attorney general over who had the power to do these, I think a presidential appointee, but not Senate confirmed, just as sort of one that pops into my head. So there are a lot of very significant, powerful positions in our government that are presidential appointees, but are not subject to Senate confirmation. And then I think I don't know the number, but I think we have a lot. And if you look at the list, a fair number of them, I think you'd say to yourself, why in the world are we making the Senate, you know, confirm these people? But right. I think a lot of the good government people who look into this think that they're probably more. And then the ones who are less important end up taking a year to get confirmed. So the government has already gone forward. And, you know, for President Biden, he was only in office for 3 years. And the last year of a presidency is frequently not all that productive. And so it does sort of slow down the whole process of getting people in place, obviously with the principal officers, cabinet officials, deputies, all that kind of stuff.
Right. But let's be clear, over 4,000 appointments are expected, because that's how many things, at least that's the data that we have, right? That it's 4,000. That's a lot of things for the Senate to consider and then carry out any other business.
Yes.
And I agree, we see them, all they seem to do all day is squabble with each other and engage in this theater, but they do have very serious work. And, you know, stuff like wasting time on lower level nominees, you know, that does interfere with things like, you know, drafting and passage of things like the National Defense Authorization Act, which is, you know, obviously huge and very and mandatory, right? And yeah, I take your point on that. I wonder if at some point, you know, that'll be further considered. But let me have you have the last word here. Is there anything you'd like to add on recess appointments? Anything else our listeners should be thinking about, looking for, considering?
So I mentioned earlier the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, and I just want to mention that quickly because it's another method that the president can use to install people in principal officer cabinet positions without Senate confirmation. It has a fair number of limitations. The person typically, it's a very complicated statute. So I'm going to give some broad outlines, but there are exceptions to almost everything I'm going to say, and I'd be here for an hour just explaining all the exceptions. But if the position is vacant, it has to be vacant through resignation. The person, the incumbent, has to either die, resign, or be otherwise unavailable to perform the functions and duties. It's actually slightly unclear if the position is vacant because the president fired the prior person, whether he can access the Federal Vacancy Reform Act or not. But if he can, the person can serve for 210 days. And there's some limitations on who can be appointed by the president. There's sort of three categories. The deputy can be appointed. But if you think about a change from one administration to another, typically, the incoming president is not going to want the deputy, because that deputy would be identified with the prior administration. The second category is anybody who was Senate confirmed anywhere in the government. And the third category is someone in the agency who's been in the agency for 90 days and is at a fairly high pay level. So let's just take the FBI, for example, which is if, as he's waiting for Mr. Patel to be confirmed, if he could find, or not, if he could find someone he thought was of his mindset in the FBI, who'd been there for more than 90 days, and was at a fairly senior pay level, he could make name that person the acting FBI director, who could serve for 210 days, possibly even longer if he then nominates Kash Patel. The one thing he can't do, he could put, I'm just using this example, Kash Patel into the FBI as an employee, and then after 90 days, name him as acting under the Federal Vacancy Reform Act. But then the statute precludes the president from nominating him, so that if he does that, Mr. Patel could serve for 210 days, but he can't get nominated. So it's 210 days, and then he's done. So anyway, I probably made okay. it sound unbelievably complicated, but I just wanted to mention there was a way, in addition to the recess appointment, that the president can name people to these very high positions. It's just a little more complicated because there are a lot of statutory provisions in government.
Well, gotcha. Okay. Well, Neil, I hate to say it's time to summarize national security law this week. Let's just say, you know, it's better to get your news from some sort of editorially reviewed publication, certainly not social media. And one of the reasons that you should do this is because, you know, Russia has had a malign influence campaign for, you know, over a decade that has been intended to undermine confidence in the U.S. judiciary, which, quite frankly, is the envy of Russia that doesn't exactly have a system on a par with ours. One thing that's very interesting, however, and this is exactly what Elizabeth Rinskoff Parker and Suzanne Spaulding have feared would happen, but the confidence in the U.S. courts has plummeted to a rate below that of other developed nations. And so you might be wondering out there, you know, why is this national security news? Again, this was part of a, you know, publicly stated over a period of time, exposed to various indictments, campaign by Russia to undermine the U.S. judiciary system. So that's an extremely concerning development, because we do want to have confidence in our judiciary. And it is a mark of a developing or troubled nation when they just don't believe in their own criminal justice system or their own legal system. And you might remember, you know, in support of this idea that this is actually something that is generated from outside the country, the Justice Department seized 32 internet domains that had been involved in this propaganda. And this poll followed very closely on when those domains were seized. So it probably accounted for people's reactions, you know, to some of the things that they were seeing on, yeah, TikTok. You heard it here. The other big news is, of course, out of Ukraine and Russia. And I found this absolutely shocking, because I don't know your reaction to it, Neil, but Ukraine has now admitted that they killed a Russian general, Igor Kirillov, who, by the way, the Karma cops were looking for him anyway, right? His time was, you know, the Karma cops are on patrol. But he was killed in a Moscow bombing attack. And this is the guy who was responsible for chemical weapons. He dropped some of that ammunition that had toxic substances onto Ukrainian troops. But you blow up in, you know, somebody inside the Kremlin like that, there's definitely going to be a response, and it's probably going to be awful. But it is true right now that Russia does appear somewhat degraded, because ships have left and they basically are giving up a warm water port that they needed, that the Syrians had facilitated for them, a Mediterranean port. And they've now absorbed Bashar al-Assad as an asylee after HTS-led rebel forces captured Damascus and Aleppo and just ran over everything. So I just find all of that a very interesting thing, but it's very hard to say what Russia will do, because traditionally when they have felt especially desperate is when they've done the most awful. So in another news about, you know, potentially wobbly partners, as I like to call them, there are reports that gross wealth disparities in South Korea are now threatening to undermine their democracy. And this has been one of the concerns in the United States, as the gross disparities in wealth between CEOs and the average workers, you know, typically and throughout history, that's been a pretty destabilizing dynamic in any country. And this all came to light after South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law, which shocked Koreans, many of whom took to the streets in protest. And just as a reminder, South Korea is one of our key strategic partners, certainly in Asia, and any political instability in South Korea is, quite frankly, a deep concern to the United States. If it isn't, it should be. And just to remember, you know, Beijing is seeking dominance in that region, and they would exploit any sort of instability in their favor. And then in sanctions don't pay dues, they really don't. The Wall Street Journal had a report that the owners and operators of numerous vessels used in sanctions evasions trade have abandoned their vessels at sea. And there are very sad photographs showing these mostly third world, you know, they're often Indonesian, Filipino crew aboard these vessels where there's no electricity, there's no food, there's no water, and there's no help. And they're thousands of miles away. They're calling them shadow fleets, and they're now formed an armada of, you know, these poorly serviced vessels that really, you know, they're marginally seaworthy at the beginning, but they were transporting all sorts of goods, including oil, in violation of sanctions. And the estimates right now are over 4,000 crewmen have been abandoned at sea. That's an incredibly large number. And of course, these are the same vessels where any actual ownership is murky at best. And then in supply chain news, always interesting for national security, the Energy Department has offered a conditional loan to Australia's Novonix to build a large facility in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And that facility would manufacture a synthetic version of a vital battery component. Why is this important? China actually has a lot of this stuff within their borders, and we need to reduce our dependency. So this could be a wonderful thing. We certainly hope. And how can AI cause a major problem for national security news? Gosh, there's so much of this week. AI scientist Heidi Kalf wrote this in several papers, but where I read it was in the Financial Times, that an AI admin tool, think about that, that is just designed to enhance efficiency in the military could actually compromise the safety of both civilian and defense infrastructure. She goes on to describe exactly how that could happen through sort of accumulation of these errors that it would necessarily deploy. No code is perfect. That's how hackers get in. That's why they have penetration testing tools. Nothing is a fortress. So that might be worth taking a look at. And really important, obviously, to my conversation last week with Glenn Gerstle is that the U.S. Supreme Court has now agreed to hear the TikTok ban case. And I'm speaking colloquially here. It's not called that. But you might remember that TikTok is obviously owned by parent company ByteDance, now heavily involved in the development of AI and chips. And one of the national security concerns, this was a China-founded company, even though it's incorporated in one of the like Cayman Islands or one of those places. So this is something to watch. They've also, not only have they said they're going to take it, but they must have said something. I don't know if you saw this, Neil. They said they're going to do it quickly.
I saw they're going to argue January 10th or something, I think.
Okay, well, I'll get the popcorn. Hopefully they'll broadcast that.
They ruined a lot of lawyers' holidays because the TikTok's brief is due December 27th, I think. So they're on a pretty fast pace here.
That's right. And Pincus had the lead on that. Well, hopefully whatever he celebrates is over. I hope he doesn't have to cancel that really great ski trip or whatever he had going on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Neil, I'm really glad you came in tonight. It was great to have this conversation, and I hope we can have another one in the future.
This was really fun. Thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you invite me back because I'll definitely take you up on it.
It's good to hear because I keep everybody's name and I do come back. So you may rue the day you ever said that. All right. But thank you, everybody, for listening to NSLT. We hope you enjoy this holiday season. Remember, we encourage you here at the Skolins to share this episode with a friend, a colleague, to discuss the issues that we have presented in a thoughtful way. One of the things we ask you to do is hear other people's points of view. The reason is, if you don't listen and you don't hear them, you will never be a great lawyer. I think a feature of a great lawyer is hearing other people's points of view, not with the hair on the back of your neck standing up. Listening and processing other people's points of view is a critical piece to developing yourself as an attorney. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is far more diverse in thought than any other. No matter what those Scandinavians say, the truth is, the secret sauce is right here, people. It's a great place to be, right? If you enjoy this cast, do us a solid. Go ahead and review it. We depend on you to review this on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or your listening app of choice. This helps us in distributing our content. And as a valued listener, we would very much appreciate it if you would do that. So in closing, our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is the ever lovely Frances Burkham. The woman of the hour, of the year, of the week, of forever is Holly McMahon, as well as the incredible members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. This is an amazing group of people, and you should come to everything they put on, or you're just crazy and missing out. But without them, this podcast would not be possible. Enjoy the holidays, and we will see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.